today is Thursday. No, today's Wednesday. January the 9th. I'm Christine Navarro interviewing Mr. Jose Cortez at 1112 Buckeye Street.
1112 East Buckeye.
1112 East Buckeye Street. The time is 4:15. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Christine.
How are you?
I'm great.
Good. I'd like to talk a little bit about your, start with your family and your background. Can you tell me your parents' names?
Sure. My parents' name, well, my father was Jose Cortez. I'm Jose Jr. My mother was Josefina Ramirez, her maiden name. I was born in a little rural village in Jalisco, just outside of Guadalajara. My father was killed when I was just a few months old, so my mother had to find a way to make sure that she provided for us, and obviously she couldn't stay at our village because women, it wasn't fashionable for women to work alongside men back in those days. So we opted to migrate to the United States without legal documents. We jumped the border at El Paso in 1950. I was 3 years old. And we couldn't stay in El Paso because, I mean, we were right next to the border, a lot of immigration. So we migrated north to Colorado in a caravan of a group of farm workers that was led by a more experienced farm worker who knew the area well and knew the farms where they would be in need of people to work the crops. When we got there, my parents, which was now my mother and who had remarried another man, my stepfather, worked for a rancher or farmer there who had a dairy farm, and he also planted, he had an agricultural field, actually quite a few, and the main crop there was sugar beets. So my parents essentially were given a place to stay and were paid, you know, very minimum wages to work there simply because they were given a free home to live in for us. And in return, we would have to do a lot of the work there. Of course, we got paid. I mean, I'm not saying we didn't get paid, but we didn't get paid what we should have. But anything was better than what would have awaited us in Mexico if my mom would have stayed there, because there was nothing that she could do to provide for us. We were there and worked for this farmer for many, many years as migrant farm workers. Well, at that time we were just farm workers because we hadn't entered the migrant stream as of yet, but because we were in constant contact with various other farm workers, and they were, one, were the migrant farm workers that were coming from Texas. They were called the Tejanos. They would come in these huge trucks that were covered with canvas, and these trucks had names on them like La Chata, La Carta Jugada, El Mujeriego, or they would give them names and they would write them on the trucks, and it was really neat. Because during the winter months, we as permanent farm workers in the farm didn't have a whole lot of contact with outside Mexicanos, Latinos. It was a lot of snow and basically living off welfare because there was no work. And that's how you survived. So in the springtime, when the migrant farm workers started to come, it was so beautiful because they would bring all these stories of what was happening in Texas, in Nuevo Mexico, in California. And And I thought they were so cool because the way they dressed. I mean, we were just simple people, farm workers. But these were the migrants. These were the pachucos. They're the ones that had the Stacys and the khakis and the thin belts. And they spoke this funny language that really made me think, wow, these guys are my idols. They're Latinos. They're tough. They know how to fight. They work hard. They drink a lot of beer. And they're just my idols. And they wore taps on their shoes. And they're greasers, too. They were greasers. And they wore tattoos. Like, they would have the cross on their forehead, on their earlobes. And that was a sign of the pachuco, which I had no clue of what a pachuco was. So these were some of the people that we had contact with. The other people that we had contact with were the braceros. These were the individuals that also came in the summertime to work. And for the most part, I had no clue what a bracero was. All I remember was that they were different because, you know, they were all single, they had no wives, and they had no children. And
why did that stand out to you?
Because everyone that lived there had a family, belonged to a family. But here's a group of men living together in a house, maybe 5, 6, 7, and they have no wives and they have no children. And I would find it strange because even though they had no families, my parents had a certain attraction towards them simply because they were from Mexico. I think now that I think about it, I think it was the fact that it made them nostalgic because some of them were wearing hats that were typical of the place where we came from, whether it was Jalisco.
Tell me a typical hat from Jalisco.
A typical hat from Jalisco is like the one that's hanging on my wall. And this was a hat that I used for 40 years when I was a farm worker, a labor organizer with Cesar Chavez. And I chose to wear that hat because of my memories as a child watching these individuals wear these hats. For example, I see these pictures here. And here's another one. See this individual here? That's just the hat that's similar, like from the state of Jalisco. Other hats are maybe from northern Mexico. This could be from another state. But I tried to identify as much as possible with those that came from Jalisco subconsciously because, I mean, I would remember their stories and, oh, this one's from Jalisco. And I would remember, oh, yeah, he's from where I come from. Wow, I wonder if this is the way my ancestors or my family that lives there still looks like. And it was really interesting. I also saw the hardship that they would go through because we had a car. I mean, it was an old car, as you can see. It was, I think, it's probably a 1938 or 39 Ford, which took us to the store and back, and sometimes they didn't bring us back. But it got us there, and we were able to get our groceries. But here, these men had to depend either on the rancher or the farmer to take them once a month to buy their groceries. But sometimes when they needed something, or maybe if they just wanted to go into town, they would ask us for rides to go into town. So my parents would always give them rides, and they were always very thankful for the ride that we gave them. They were always very thankful when my mom would make extra tortillas and I would go over and take to them and say, here, my mom sent these to you. And they were really thankful for that. And I remember that, you know, sometimes when they would get paid, they'd give me a quarter, maybe 50 cents. And I thought that was really great. But, you know, just to live in those times, growing up in the 50s in Colorado, being part of this whole this environment where you're constantly surrounded by hard work and farm workers. It helps to nurture you and prepare you for what you're going to do in the future. I think a lot of that was very instrumental in molding me into the person that I am today, because being a farm worker child, I had to endure a lot of discrimination from two sides. One, which was the Anglo side, which discriminated against because of our color, and then we were also discriminated against from other Mexican American children who were second and third generation, and you know, they would call us mojados, and you know, and just you name it, and that I think that's what even hurt more than anything else, because here's my own people making fun of me, and I said, why are they making fun of me? I couldn't understand that I was just a poor child, and it wasn't until I started to grow up a little bit, probably, I'm thinking maybe when I started to get into the fifth and sixth grade, that I started to realize that my mom all these years had made shirts for me out of old flour sacks, and I said, and I thought they were the neatest things in the world, until I realized that this is why a lot of the kids made fun of me, because I wore those shirts.
How old were you?
When I used to wear my flour sack shirts, I was probably first, second, and third grade. When I started to get into fourth grade, I started to realize that, you know, in order to be hip, you had to wear what everybody else was wearing. And I remember my teacher used to tell me, God, your mom is such a really neat person. She makes these shirts for you. And I thought so too. And then afterwards, when I started to feel embarrassed, things started to change. And then, you know, with all the discrimination, the prejudice, you know, it just really started to make me into a very angry young man. My parents started talking to a lot of the farm workers. I mean, a lot of the farm workers that were migrant workers, and they would tell us, you know, you guys are here year-round. What you need to do is go with us. We'll take you to a place where there's plenty of work year-round, and you don't have to live off welfare anymore. So, but my parents were terrified because we didn't have any documents. We didn't have papers of travel. So they held off until finally we were able, I think it, when I was 12 years old, we were able to get our documents in order. We got our resident alien visas and everything. So now we were legal, so my parents said, well, now we can travel. So we decided that we were going to make the journey to Phoenix, Arizona. So we had a 1949 Buick at the time, which was, well, I thought it was a pretty neat car, but I didn't realize how old it was. But everything that we owned, we put in that car. I mean, pots, pans, and I think of the Beverly Hillbillies, and I can relate to that when we left Colorado. And I think one of the saddest things that from our departure was the fact that, you know, I had my dogs, and that was one thing I had to leave behind. So needless to say, a child, 12 years old, you leave your dogs behind that you've established this bond with. And it was very traumatic for me. I mean, to sit there and watch my dogs run after the car until they couldn't run anymore. And here I am just watching, you know, out of the rear window, bawling and crying. And it was really traumatic. And I think to this day, I think this is one of the reasons why I love dogs so much, because, you know, I was literally torn apart from something that I loved. I mean, just as much as I loved my family, my two dogs, and that was the last I ever saw of them. So it was very traumatic for me. But, you know, again, these are the kinds of things that start to harden you and start to make you into the person that you are. So when we came here to Arizona, and this is very ironic because when we first arrived here in 1960, this particular neighborhood where we're sitting right now,
which is the
Nuestro Barrio, we arrived, there was an old Chino store just half a block west of here. And that's where we ended up. This was like the beacon for all the farm workers coming from out of state. And I'll tell you why. Very important. Because this area, which is a very centrally located area, you had the store where you could buy cheap bread and bologna. There was a park nearby where you could spend the night in your car. And in the morning, the men could walk over to where the ballpark is, which is, half a mile away. And then that's where the labor buses would pick up the men and take them to work. And so, again, all the farm workers who came and who found themselves in a desperate situation, this is where they would end up. And ironically, this is where I ended up. And here I am, you know, 60, 48 years later, and I'm still in the same area, in this neighborhood, and I'm working hard to document a history of individuals who have been very active in our community throughout the years, and including Cesar Chavez. So I guess in a nutshell, that's
you've gone full circle.
Yeah,
you started here and you came back.
Yeah, so it's and I think this is where I'm going to end my life. You know, I'm certain that this is why Arizona is my calling, and I've established very deep roots here. I've managed to start the first bilingual radio station here in the Valley in 1981. I have been...
What was the name of it?
It was called La Firme. It was KIFN Radio. That was a very significant part of my life. Another very significant part of my life was the fact that I was part of the farm worker movement, right along with Cesar Chavez. Even though I wasn't a great person like Cesar Chavez, but I could feel everything that Cesar felt, including the spirituality. And I think this is one of the reasons why I have been so involved in organizing Cesar Chavez events. In fact, the first one that I started was in 1994, the year after he died. And every year I've been organizing events year after year. And now I'm working in close contact with the Cesar Chavez Foundation to continue the legacy. And in fact, in 2002, something else that is really significant was the fact that Santa Rita, which is the birthplace, which is one of the first offices of Chicanos por la Causa, and was also the place where Cesar Chavez fasted in 1972, CPLC have, for the most part, hadn't done anything to try and preserve it. So feeling a need, feeling this spiritual, inspirational push, I started to organize events around Santa Rita. And this is where this picture comes from. It's actually a painting that I had done. And so that is Santa Rita, and that's where they're taking Cesar out of the Santa Rita Hall in 1972 after the 24th day when he was fasting. And in the real painting, there's a drawing of me, but I just put this in there just to remind myself that through a inspirational vision, I was motivated to start the effort of educating the community of the importance of this historical jewel that would someday tell the story not only of the founders of CPLC, but also of Cesar Chavez. So this is why this little niche is so important to me. It tells a story that not only shows Santa Rita, but here's a picture of me when I was organizing with Cesar Chavez with my hat when it was a lot sturdier. This is Cesar Chavez and one of his friends. This is one of the oldest farm workers that I know that lives here in the area. And of course, this is Cesar Chavez and Coretta Scott King at Santa Rita. So these are some of the things that I think are really important to my life. So,
do you need to get that?
Yeah. No, I'll go ahead. It'll just get buzzy.
Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about when you first were in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
and your experience with the Resetos. You mentioned that you went to Colorado, that you followed an older farm worker. Do you remember his name and anything about him?
Oh, gosh. I don't remember. All I remember is there was because I was at the time, I was only like three, maybe four. And all I remember is a caravan of old cars driving. We drove for many days. I better answer this. Go on.
Okay, and also you mentioned that there were actual names painted on the trucks.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who painted those names? And
yeah, the owner, each owner of the truck felt a personal relationship with the truck, and maybe he named it after his mother, maybe after a girlfriend, or maybe he named it after how he felt. How he saw himself, but it pretty much brought the individual, which is the owner of the truck, it gave him a way to personalize his vehicle to reflect something of his life.
Can you tell me a little bit about your experiences, Brasetos, was it in different states or just Colorado? Or
it was Colorado. This is where I first learned what a Vaceto was as a young boy.
Now, how did you find out?
I asked my mother, and I said, "You know what? Why don't they have kids?" And she would tell me, "Porque son braceros." Okay, ¿y qué es bracero? And then she explained to me that these were men that were brought from Mexico for the specific reason that to work in the fields. And they would work for a certain length of time, and then they would go back. And in their case, they only came for the summertime because that's the only time that there was work in Colorado, and the farmer had no work for them in the wintertime. So that's why she said, that's why they got to go back. And so I said, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. So once I understood where they were from, I kind of felt, I stronger bond with them because I knew that they were also from Mexico. I knew that they were also hard workers like we were. And I knew that, for the most part, whether they wanted to, they had to work or not, and so did we. I mean, as long as the crops were there, we had to work. And then being the fact that they spoke Spanish and they got along really well with my parents, it was interesting because it you almost looked at them like an extension of your family, like, all right, well, they're not really my family, but I guess they could be, you know, because, you know, we're from the same area, we have the same culture, we have the same language, and, you know, we all get discriminated against because of who we are. Because I could see the people when they went to the stores, you know, they'd look at them, and they look at their clothes, you know, say, oh, these guys smell bad, and, you know, and you know, and we were pretty much just like them, you know. We sometimes we would go straight from the field, you know, drop them off at the store, let them pick up their supplies, and drive back home. And I would see how people would make fun of them and point their fingers at them. And us too, because we were, you know, we were Mexicanos and we spoke no English. Actually, I was the only one that spoke a little English in those days, because I was going to school. So
how did they communicate it with the store owners?
They really didn't. Sign language, how much, cuánto, you know. But for the most part, they, you know, that's why they would always give me money, because I was kind of like their interpreter. So that's how I started to learn more about them. And, I mean, you can't help to learn about an individual, because you're there constantly, and you're listening to their stories, you're listening to their conversations.
What do you remember from their stories or conversations?
Oh, gosh, I remember some would look at me and become nostalgic. Oh, yo tengo un hijo como tú, está como de tu edad, y vive en tal lugar, y hace esto y lo otro. Or they would talk to my mom, oh, señora, usted hace muy buena comida, me recuerda de mi esposa. Oh, señor, muchas gracias, se lo agradezco mucho. A usted, a su familia, and things like this. And so, you know, it reminded you so much of what it could be like if you were living in Mexico, in your town, in your state, and had all your relatives there. And for them to live next to us, it was also, I guess, for them it was a blessing, because, again, we provided them rides to the store, and I helped them in whatever I could with what little English I knew, but it was better than nothing.
Now, you mentioned food that your mom would send tortillas over. Mm-hmm. Do you remember if they were... if their meals were provided, or if they cooked within their own?
The where we lived, the farmer would take them either once every 2 weeks or once a week to get their groceries, and they would have to make their own meals. So they would, but so whenever my mom made anything that was homemade, I mean, they certainly appreciated it, because it was an opportunity for them to taste a home-cooked meal other than what they had to make. And for the most part, I remember that all they ever made was beans and fideo, and just simple stuff, you know, because they, caldo and stuff like that.
Most men had never cooked before.
In some, yeah. No, in some cases, I'm sure some of them had never cooked other than beans and then tortillas, you know, back then. You couldn't go buy Tia Conchita's tortillas. I mean, you had to buy the flour and make your own, and that's why my mom had so many old flour sacks. We would, when we bought flour, she would buy the 50-pound bags, and I remember that when they left, you know, they would always give us their old flour sacks, because they knew that my mom could use them. So. Very good memories. And then when we came to Phoenix in 1960, we came at the tail end of the Bracero movement, so we still got to see some Braceros here, and for the most part they worked out in the Tolleson, Avondale, Litchfield area, and we were living out in Tolleson.
Do you remember any farms that were out there or anything? The names of the farms?
I don't remember the names, but I do remember the camps where they lived.
Which were?
There was one camp right there on Northern and, Camel, let's see. I can't remember the exact cross
street. That's okay.
But it was out in the west side. There was quite a few, actually. There's quite a few. There was another one right there on Indian School. And Camel Indian School and Waddell Road. But as I mentioned, there were several out in that area because before there was a lot of during the 40s when there wasn't a whole lot of farm workers here, that's when they were bringing the bracero. But over the years, there's always been Phoenix has always been a place where a lot of your migrant farm workers coexisted right alongside the bracero. And again, we were when we got here in the 60s, we did that for a few years. We saw them working.
Was there any conflict between the two groups?
No, there was really never any conflict because there was they were here. They did their part, their work, and obviously there weren't enough of them, and this is why other migrant farm workers came and helped out in picking the crops, especially the lettuce, which was very abundant here in the west side. A lot of lettuce, potatoes, onions. So when we came and to this area, and then picking the oranges and grapefruit, there was a lot of oranges and grapefruits, and also grapes.
What brought your family to Arizona?
The fact that there was work for, there was farm work for more months out of the year than there was in Colorado. In Colorado, you could probably work from, I would say, early spring, maybe April or May, to probably the end of September. So there wasn't that many months that you could work. The rest of the time, you had to live off welfare, and that wasn't very fun because you had to. For a child that's going to school and there's no income, you have to wear maybe the same pair of socks for the whole week, or your shoes get holes in them and you still have to wear them with holes, and so it was a rough time. That's why we came to Phoenix, because again we were advised by other migrant farm workers that coming here you could work practically all year except for a few months in the summertime, but then during those very extremely hot months you could go up north to California and work in the cucumbers and the apricots and other crops that grew in California. So again, there was work year round.
Did you work in the fields?
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah, I worked right along when I wasn't going to school. I was right there, right alongside my stepfather working in the fields. In fact, even after I graduated from high school, because I was so entrenched in farm worker life, I felt terrified of living in the city. And working at a warehouse or anything else, I continued working in the field, and that's when that's when I met Cesar Chavez. Actually, I met him because of my parents. They started going to the meetings, and my mom started dragging me to the meetings to drive her because she couldn't drive. And that's how I started getting involved with Cesar Chavez.
What year was that?
Oh, gosh. I want to say in the probably in the late 60s.
What was your initial meeting like?
I don't know. I didn't want to be associated with what they were doing because I wanted to be an all-American kid. I didn't want to be associated with farm workers. I felt embarrassed, and especially because I had a girlfriend and I didn't want her to see me involved with these individuals and have her make fun of me. I guess I didn't want to go through the whole routine of being a victim of prejudice and discrimination.
What changed your mind?
I started listening to what he had to say, and I started to realize that what he was saying was so true, and that those of us that had the ability to help others should really take advantage of the fact that you were given these skills and this talent. And then I started to listen, and I said, wow, this guy is making a lot of sense. So even though I listened, I still wasn't going to jump in head first. I started to volunteer just to pass out flyers and do stuff like that. And in the process of passing out flyers and meeting to people and talking to them, I started to really, everything that had happened to me throughout my life all of a sudden were the elements that made me into who I was. Everything that I had experienced, the anger and the fear of the farm worker bosses, everything just came into play. It was like, wow, these were the ingredients that had been laying dormant, and now all of a sudden this man had awakened them, and here I was. All of a sudden, I was an individual that I no longer was. I didn't care. I wanted to go and become a Chicano and fight for the rights of my people. And that's where, and this was during the time that the civil rights movement was coming into play. So it just hit me like a ton of bricks. All of a sudden, I started reading books on Corky Gonzalez. I started reading books on Lopez Tijerina. Yeah, I started reading more books on Cesar, and then it just hit me. Wow, I'm all for Chicano power, and that's where I started to develop my hunger for activism, and I became involved with Cesar. And over the years, obviously, you go through certain phases of maturity, and you realize that. At that time, Chicano power was important, and this is how this organization was born, out of that hunger for social justice. But obviously, over the years now, my ideals have changed, and I'm looking at the bigger picture. I'm looking at a human being, not just Chicanos or blacks, or Jews. I'm looking at a human being and social justice. And I think that's one of the major changes that has occurred in my life. But yet, I feel very empathetic to the plight of the recent immigrants, because I was one of them. I made that trip. I went through the whole process of being a mojado, a Chicano, a Mexican American, and now a human being who's colorblind. I know there's good people in all walks of life, and I think that I I finally understood what Sessad was trying to tell us when he said nonviolence. We need to employ nonviolent tactics. There was a time when I couldn't understand that because I had so much anger that had been repressed. But now I understand, and I think that's the spiritual connection that a lot of us go through life trying to find.
Do you think as you get older, you understand more?
Yes, for some people, not all, because there's some people who never are able to outgrow that anger, and it just destroys them. But if you can understand that you need to get away from all that, and you need to focus on the broader picture, I think that it'll truly help you make that spiritual connection that we all need, and that's so very powerful.
I'd like to ask you a few more questions. Mm-hmm. Can we go back to the camp in Colorado? Do you remember the name of the camp in Colorado?
The camp in Colorado. Actually, it wasn't really a camp because there where we lived with a what farmers would do. You know, if they had a dairy, or if they had a farm, if they had crops, they would usually have several houses, and some houses would be allotted to the families of farm workers, whether they were the permanent or the migrant. And then they had one specifically for the braceros.
How many braceros would come in at any period of time?
Well, in that particular farm, I would say maybe 7 or 8, and they all lived in one house during that time. But if you would go to town on weekends, you could see that other braceros who lived in other farms would come in, and the grocery stores became like the meeting point where you could see everybody coming in on weekends, Saturdays especially, Saturday afternoons, because people would work maybe up until noon on Saturday. And then in the afternoon, everybody would run home and take a quick, I was a shower, but there was no such thing as showers. You would jump in a tub because there was no running water.
There was no running water?
No.
Was there any facilities, like bathroom facilities?
No, you had an outhouse, and then you had one of those old-time hand pumps where you'd pump the water out.
It's cold.
It was ice cold, especially in Colorado. And then you would just take a quick rinse and, all right, let's go to town. And
would you go with them?
Yeah. I mean, God, as a child, I mean, God, you look forward to. I mean, this was the trip that made your week, even if it was just to go to the store and get a 15-cent hamburger or a soda and a bag of peanuts to put inside your Coca-Cola. This was wow. I mean, you couldn't ask for anything more. And to sit there and watch these people. I mean, I would sit in the car and just watch all these people coming from all the different ranches and all the different farms just for the specific purpose of shopping, buying their groceries, and going back home.
Did you ever hear them talk about any farmer that was maybe extremely racist or hard on them or they would identify?
You know what? I would hear them complain, and not a whole bunch of them. For the most part, I think a lot of the ranchers and the farmers were just happy to get their crops picked, and they made an effort to take care of the braceros. But then, like anything else, there's those who have the need, but yet, you know, once you've served them, they don't really want to get to know you that well. And you see that even today. I mean, you see these huge corporations that want you as a worker, but they want nothing to do with you afterwards. So, yeah.
Can you tell me when you worked in the fields as well? Mm-hmm. You were sharing a story about because you were You were under 14 when you worked.
Yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Sure. Well, obviously, you know, the only time that you could work in the field was in the summertime in Colorado. So, and unfortunately, you get out of school in back then I can't remember. I think it was in early, probably. When do you get out of school? Sometime in May. Mm-hmm. Okay, so from the time that I got out of school till the time that it was, till the time I went back to school. In other words, all my summer vacation was spent working in the fields. For me, there was no swimming. There was no camping trips. There was no skateboarding. Nothing. It was like, you're going to work, and you're going to work just like everybody else, from sunrise to sunset. There's no clocks here. You know, when as soon as we're able to see, we'll start working, and 30 minutes before it gets dark, we go home. And so that was my job, obviously, because I was underage. My job early in the morning was to get the water ready for the day. So I would have to fill these jugs that we used. Back then we didn't have thermos bottles or anything. You would save all these old wine bottles, and then they would cover them with burlap sacks.
Mm-hmm.
And you would fill up these bottles full of water and then just wet the burlap, and that would keep them cool. To take out into the field. So my job was to make sure that we had water. And God help you if you forgot, because if we ran out of water, that meant that you were going to get a whipping. And I'm talking a whipping with cord or whatever they could find. So, and needless to say, that only happened to me once. I forgot. But you learn very quickly when the punishment is that severe. So after you get there, you're warned that you have to be very careful. Don't stray too far away from the end, because if you see a strange car come into the field, it could be the field man, and that's what they call him. Back then, I had no idea what a field man was. But they never said field man. They said el field man. So that's why I couldn't understand. Te cuidas por el field man. Oh, what's a field man? Okay. Si ves un gabacho que grandote que trae papeles, corres y te escondes. Okay. So I had been forewarned. Y si te dejas agarrar, vas a ver la joda que te acomodamos. And I said, okay. So, yeah, so anytime I saw a strange car, I would...
Did you see some?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They would make their rounds, and, just to make sure that... Sometimes they would come to the major of the fields to... Because, I mean, you got paid by the acre.
How much did you get paid? Do you remember?
God, I don't remember. I don't remember, but I
do... Were you paid by cash or by check?
It was... Sometimes they would pay us by check, and sometimes cash. So I have no idea how much we made. All I know is that if I worked, that I would, when we went to the store, I would probably end up with maybe 25 cents or 50 cents, and that was enough to get me a soda, peanuts. And then if I was lucky, my mom would probably buy me something other than just that. Maybe a shirt for school or maybe a pair of pants. And this was really neat. I mean, considering that we had nothing during the winter. I mean, we had to... God, I remember there was times where we had to take sandwiches, mustard sandwiches, because that's all we had. And there was nothing else. Mom was like, well, just put mustard on it. And then there was other times when there wasn't even bread, so she would... she'd get an old mason jar and fill it up with beans and say, here, this is your lunch. Mom, I can't take that. Well, that's all there is. So my little brother and me would when we get to school, there was an old cornfield where they had already picked the corn, and you know the stalks are already drying. He said, "Go and hide our jar of beans there." And then at lunchtime, we'd get together, and then we'd run to the cornfield, and then we'd start taking drinks of the corn of the mason jar, just drinking beans, and that was our lunch. So there was some really, really hard times. And then another event is like sometimes because my parents couldn't afford tennis shoes, so if it was snowing outside, we had to play in the gym, and they wouldn't allow us with street shoes in the gym. So they would say, "Well, you need to take off your shoes if you want to play in the gym." And my brother and I would never want to do that. And one day they said, "Well, you're going to have to do it today." And I said, "Oh my God, I had holes this big in my sock. God, so I just closed my eyes and took my shoes off, and I walked on into the floor, hoping that no one would notice. And well, you know, it was wishful thinking, because I mean that's the first thing they noticed. So you can imagine what devastation that caused to me.
And how old were you?
God, 8, 9, maybe 10, somewhere in that area. But very traumatic, very, very traumatic. And again, these are the experiences that helped to mold me on who I am today. That's why when I see that there's a need, I always volunteer for it, you know, because I know that if I've been blessed over the years, then, you know, maybe I've been blessed for a reason. Maybe the man of service wants me to give back, you know, in payment for what he's blessed me with. And having lived through those experiences has made me a stronger individual.
Did your mother ever say anything about the bracitos to you, not to interact, or not for your sister as well, for her safety?
No, actually, you know, as far as my mom and my sister, they never really interacted. It was mostly me.
Okay.
It was mostly me. I was the one that was, you know, always back and forth. And I was really intrigued. And, you know, and back then, because women were, there were stricter guidelines in when there was interaction between men and women. It was just considered not something to do. I mean, today, I mean, no one would even think of questioning it, but back then, I mean, it was something that was not done, especially if you were a first-generation Mexicano family. That was a no-no. I mean, women knew, you know, what they had to do, and it was just accepted as such. Again, me, I was a young kid, and I was very interested in getting a quarter here and a quarter there. So,
what would they pay you to? I mean, to help them do? I mean, what kind of
again,
errands or?
They would always give me a quarter because they knew that every time we went to the store, I would translate for them, or if they needed help in learning a word, they would say, "Hey, ¿cómo se dice esto? Ven, enséñame." "Oh, sure," and I would teach them. And I was sitting there, and I remember one guy, one word they could never say was wood. And he says, "¿Cómo se dice leña?" And then, "Wood." So I sat there for hours, and this guy could never get it. Good. And it was, these are the things that I think back, and there were some that could actually, that had instruments, you know. Maybe a guitar. They bought a guitar after they'd been there for a while, and they would sit out there and play, and I would listen to them, and that helped to inspire me over the years in terms of appreciating Mexican music.
Is that the first time you'd heard it, or just?
Well, living out there in those farms, a lot of the farm workers who associated with us, there was no nightclubs for us to go to. So
did they have radios? Did they purchase?
We had radios, but again, there was no nightclubs for Mexicanos. And there was bars and things, but there was no actual nightclub. So the people would actually take advantage of a cumpleaños, you know. Oh, it's going to be so-and-so's birthday. Let's have a party. Okay, well, so-and-so can play the violin. So-and-so can play the accordion. So-and-so can play the guitar. Let's round everybody together. And they would come from miles away just to be in that party. And they would maybe barbecue a pig and drink a lot of Coors beer. And they would play. And they'd have these poor musicians playing all day and part of the night and maybe into the wee hours of the morning, but it was really interesting, and I had the chance to really be part of that. And again, when I heard the braceros playing their guitar, and they would play songs that I wasn't familiar with.
Else would they do for recreation when they had time off?
That, write letters. A lot of them would just sit outside and smoke their cigarettes and think and reminisce, especially in the evening. There wasn't really a whole lot of free time because, I mean, these guys, they worked just like we did from sunrise to sunset. And then they had to, wash their clothes. They had to, on weekends, go shopping. And, I would say probably for the most part just singing, playing the guitar, writing letters, and just maybe taking a walk down the road, because back then there was nothing but dirt roads in Colorado where we lived out on the farms. But there wasn't a whole lot that they could do.
Do you remember how they got their letters mailed?
Yeah, there was a mailbox, and they would put it in the mailbox, and the mailman would come, I think, once or twice a week, pick up the mail, and it would take it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. To wrap up, can you tell me what you thought of the Bracero program, your personal views on that?
Then or now?
Let's try then, and then we'll go to now.
Then? I thought... I really didn't think too much of it because I was a kid, but what I could gather from it, I thought it was pretty neat because it was allowing individuals to come and make money and send back to their families. I thought it was pretty neat simply because I knew that that's why we had come here, because there wasn't a whole lot of money for us where we came from. So I figured that, God, they're making money. I know that it's hard work, but at least they're making money sending back home. And then that's how I perceived it then. Now, after learning about the whole Bracero movement, when it took place, why it took place, I realized that there were some good things that came from it, obviously. But then there are, the fact that they were cheated out of their money, that's what bothered me. I said, someone somewhere knew that what was happening is wrong, and yet they took advantage of these innocent individuals, and that's what bothers me. And because I have a conscience, and because I also have family members. My father, before he was killed, was a bracero. He had come here as a bracero.
Do you know for how many years?
He was here for one tour, and I think, I don't know how long it lasted, but...
Do you know where he went?
I had no idea. Now, my uncle, I know he ended up in California. He was my dad's younger brother. He was there. Two of my uncles were in California, working over there.
You know how often they worked as a bracero, or
they? As far as I can remember their stories, in talking to them, they came for, they did one stint, and I'm not sure for what length of time, but I know they have pictures of themselves because I saw the pictures where they were working in the farms in California. And, of course, they were very young men at the time. My uncle that still lives, he's probably right now in his mid-80s. And he would always talk about his stories.
Do you remember any stories that they shared?
All I remember was the fact that when I used to talk, when I knew him as a younger man, he would always wear three roses pomade, and I said, "How did you get hooked on that?" He says, "When I was a bracero," he said, "that's how I used to slick my hair back like the pachucos." I said, "Wow, that's really interesting." Yeah. And
did he say why? Just like the look?
It was because it was the in thing, you know. Like, okay, for example, now if there's certain colognes which are fashionable. Well, back then, if you wore Three Roses pomade, which was the top of the line, you were a hit with the girls. And then if you slicked your hair back with a lot of pomade, I mean, you were what they called us back then, Mexican greasers. So, yeah, I mean, if you wanted to make a hit with the girls, that's what you had to wear.
Did he tell you where he went to work? What state or...?
Both of my uncles ended up in California.
Okay.
They were working, they did mostly citrus.
Okay.
Picking oranges in California.
Yeah. Wow. Do you have, you said you had pictures of, your uncles had pictures?
Yeah, unfortunately they're in Guadalajara.
Oh, wow.
They went back.
They did, why?
Yeah. Both of my uncles had land there, and so they, once they finished their stint as a bracero, they went back and they started to raise a family and never decided to come back.
So they stayed in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
Do they have fond memories, or did they speak fondly in the program? Or
yeah, you know what? For the most part, they would. For them, I guess being young men at the time, coming to a country where they made money, it was exciting. They talked about all the good times. They also talked about some of the sad times,
such as
being away from your family, being in a country where where very few people speak your language, where the culture is different, and just coming here and work.
Was that hard on them?
Yeah, I remember them saying, "Yeah, it was hard. Sometimes you felt like you wanted to go back, but you couldn't. You were stuck."
Why were they stuck? Why did they choose to come here in the first place, do you think?
To make enough money to get a good start in Mexico. Because they had been campesinos in Mexico all their life. So they wanted to save enough money where they can start a little business, or maybe buy a tractor, or maybe even build a house for their family that was young. And or one of my uncles, he had never got married, so he wanted to save enough money to get married.
So that's why he became a bracero?
Yeah. So this was, for them, this was the American dream. And, you know, just like we have the American dream, you know, we want to be part of the society. They had their American dream too. But, you know, obviously theirs was to make enough money and then go back to Mexico. And I know a lot of them stayed behind. I know one of my uncles that came as a bracero. He actually came back and brought his family with him. And they ended up living in right outside of Los Angeles and lived there for many years. And now his kids, which are my cousins, still live here in California. One has decided to go back to our hometown and build a house and live there again. So it's funny how some decide to stay and some decide to go back. I personally love my hometown. I have very strong roots there, but I have stronger roots in here. And, you know, this is where I'm going to be. This is where I'm going to end up. I know. I have my kids here. I have my family here. And this is something that's going to be very important for me.
Do you have any closing thoughts that you would like to, that we didn't cover about the program or about Cesar Chavez, or a closing story that you would like to end on?
No, the only thing that I can say is that I'm really glad that there are individuals like yourself, all the students that I came in contact with, and myself, that have this desire to preserve our history. It's almost like the life of these past individuals continues to live through us, and whether we like it or not, they're going to keep working through us to make sure that their story is told. And I think that that's what drives me to continue working. And when I first started preserving my pictures, my stories, I had no idea what I was going to do or how I was going to do it. I just knew it had to be done. And as I continue with what I'm doing, I keep running across individuals like Elizabeth, Justino, yourself, the students, and more, Dr. Cuadras, Chris Marin, all these people that share the same passion. And I see us, again, you know, we're the ones that were chosen to be the tools of those individuals that have lived and gone, but lived through us. Yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.